Good morning and welcome to Home Fires Radio Show. I'm delighted to have in the studio with me this morning Frederica Martin, a recent recipient of an honorary doctorate from the University of Alaska Fairbanks during the 1985-86 graduation ceremonies. Welcome.
Thank you. You can't imagine how happy I am to be here.
It is indeed an honor to receive such a degree, and you are a justifiably worthy recipient.
Thank you. I try to be.
I've heard universal praise for your selection. I'm going to step way back and let you introduce yourself to the audience. Where were you born?
In a very romantic place, Cooperstown, New York, and brought up in the aroma of Cooper's novels. So that once going home in my third grade, I met an Indian coming down the street. And I said, "Hello, Mr. Uncas," and held out my hand to him. He looked exactly as I thought he should. And then later I was told that there was someone taking a movie back in the woods.
But it didn't shock you at all.
No,
Fenimore Cooper's novel should come to life.
Oh, no. They were very alive to me.
It was not a large town at that time?
It's still very much. I was there in 77. It's barely changed from when I used to walk down through the town reading a book and everybody looked out, not running over me with their horses, or the little old ladies with electric cars in those days.
There were some electric cars in Cooperstown
yes.
then. You chose a career. How did you get to the point where you had a career at a time when not every woman did?
Well, I really didn't know what to do. I read too many books and had too many notions, and I was very inquieto, as they say in Spanish. And so I happened to visit a cousin of mine who was an Episcopal minister in Philadelphia. And he was unmarried, so I stayed boarding with St. Margaret nuns, Episcopal nuns. And I found them such a group of interesting women doing all sorts of interesting work. And one day, one of them suggested, why didn't I go to New York and help Sister Miriam in charge of Trinity Mission House? And she was looking for a librarian. I seemed to know enough about books to be an amateur librarian. So I went, and I spent 2 years there, 2 very happy years. During that time, of course, everyone decided I would make a good nun, except myself. And I had special lectures from social workers. They arranged all sorts of odd little things for me to learn and to stay in the path of service to mankind. And I decided that nursing was the best thing, that it was a profession that called upon you for strength of body and mind and will. And they had organized many years before a hospital in Jersey City, and I decided to go there. They were no longer connected, but they had ties of affection. Oh, yes, they were connected. They ran a home yet for unwed mothers, and we got the unwed mothers to help them have their children still in Christ Hospital.
The nuns were responsible for a lot of social service at that time.
Every time, yes. They were much freer. We were always being stopped in the street by a Catholic priest and saying, what are you doing on the street alone? Because they had to travel with pairs that they couldn't.
Uh-huh.
And he'd say, but no, we don't have anything to do with you. I didn't say anything. The nun would try to explain. And there was, it was a very varied region in New York. There were Syrians, there were Arabs of all different dissensions and declensions. And Slavic people, I get such an admiration for immigrants, for the reason is that they were in such awful buildings that the stairways were usually like an open toilet. If you picked your way up to see the people, you went into a spotless house and were given delicious food. I mean, I was young enough to take any food that anybody gave me.
What? Where was the neighborhood?
In Lower New York, in Manhattan.
Lower East Side.
Well, by that time there wasn't much difference. We were on that peak that goes down.
Right, East Side, West Side. What was the year?
That must have been, until I left there in 1920. I can't really remember.
But anyway.
I went into training from there, and I finished that in 1929. So 26 to 20, 26 I left there.
I lived on the Lower East Side for a while in those buildings. They've gone through a variety of changes. They were built as tenements, and they've sort of been resuscitated from time to time.
Where I went, the last time I was home in 77, I went down to Fulton Street, and I found that they built this huge building right over my old home.
The new fish market?
It's the World Trade
Market. Oh, the World Trade Center. Oh,
that
yes.
just covered everything down there.
Yes, it's amazing. It's an amazing idea. I was staying with a friend in New York fairly recently, and her grandmother has a large collection of books of Manhattan, well, actually going back to the 1800s, 19th century. And what amazing changes, and amazing that they can do that kind of construction where there's such dense building already, just the way it changes. We think we have troubles with construction here. Try building a skyscraper in New York. It's it's really difficult.
I was so glad that St. Mark's Chapel was left on Broadway. And Trinity, too.
Oh, there are some wonderful old landmarks. So you went to nurse's school, and you graduated in 1929, and then what job did you take?
I went to Fordham Hospital to take over the pediatric division for a year or so. And then I fell in love and got married. So I didn't do much nursing for several years, but then I felt that I was getting kind of rusty, and I shouldn't. So I spent one summer out on one of the islands in which there were hospitals on the East River, and then City Island. I was always very happy doing things, and the people, you know, there were always new people that were wonderful. And shortly after that, the war in Spain began, and I had been watching fascism grow, and I read Hitler's book, and I decided he had a great influence with the people in Spain, I mean, who were causing the war. But I didn't think in terms of being adequate to go. Kind of nursing I'd done wasn't much surgery either, you know, and things. So I was helping prepare a banquet for a lord who was coming from England to raise funds for medical aid to Spain. And they called me from the nurses' union and about our office. We were called the Anti-Nazi Literature Committee. It's the worst snobbish little committee in naming that I ever encountered, and I'm out of habit of getting into committees, it seems. So if you wanted to be a member, you paid $5 a month, and we sent you a piece of literature that actually came from Germany. Now, but the kind of thing that if anybody caught in the street, they'd go to jail or be killed. But the sailors were always smuggling this stuff in for us, and people were gladly paying for it. I've never found anybody who kept a collection, because once or twice I have put in ads in places, if you have any of this, nothing shows up.
It's so hard to know what to save. I look at things and say, I wonder if this is going to be important in 20
years. I didn't save anything,
years.
And I'm an accumulator, not a collectionist.
So the idea was to disseminate literature to show what was going on in inside of Germany.
You'd have a little prayer book, and you'd turn the pages, and then there would be a description of what had happened here and so forth.
Because in general, in the press, it wasn't well known.
It wasn't well known, and yet it was. I was surprised. Some years ago when particularly my nurses insisted that I write a history of us, and I said I won't write a history of another medical adventure. But if I can find out enough about the committee which sent us, the people in it, then I will, because that's the important thing to tell. And I knew a great deal about it, because when I came back from Spain, I was asked to come back before the war was over and speak for 3 or 4 months. And I said, I can't speak, you know. And finally a friend in the committee wrote, audience no worse war, come home. I said, well, probably not. So I'll try anyway. And I thought, oh, I was so excited. I'm going to fly across the United States, and I'm going to see all this wonderful country of ours. And I fell sound asleep, and they woke me up in Spokane and dragged me off the plane. I had a very good rest. And I got along very well and learned talking, and I was only embarrassed at times, eventually, if there was a university or a college in any town I had to speak to. And teachers would give me a party afterwards, of course, and somebody would say, I'd try and guess who would do it. And where did you go to college, Miss Martin? Oh, I never went to college. I went to nursing after high school. You never went to college? You mean that? No, I never did. And several voices would say, but how did you learn to speak? I said, I'm learning now.
On-the-job training, one of the original on-the-job training.
So that kept me so busy that I didn't go back to Spain because Negrín naively thought he was the head of the Republican government and a very wonderful human being. And he thought if he could prove to the world that they didn't have thousands of Reds over there working for them, if they sent the volunteers home, then there would be more help from other countries. It didn't work out that way. Quite the opposite. I've just been reading some of the diaries of the Germans, and they had great contempt for Franco and great fear of him. They thought they couldn't trust him. Especially Goebbels' diary is very interesting. If all the world had known about what the Germans really thought of them, they would have had a different change. But honest Catholics, my family, I must always tell this story. The Martin family, they came over in the 50s from Ireland. And seems as though my grandfather was pretty prosperous because he immediately bought two farms, one in New York and one in the Berkshires. And proceeded to have children, and since she was Catholic and he was Protestant, when he was on a walking tour from Trinity College, he went in Galway. He saw this beautiful barefooted girl feeding pigs, and he married her. It took a fight with the family, and especially over the religious question, you know. It must have been pretty filled. But he was a
student. At that time.
Yes.
My goodness, from Ireland.
So they finally gave in and kept him about a year so that Uncle John was born before they decided to dispose of him in America. And we don't have any clue because they cut all in, there's no trace of any relationships or correspondence or friendship in it. And we're not exactly sure except the phrase, your grandmother came from Galway and your father from the north of Ireland. And I always thought, well, you know, he's over among the Protestants there. But no, he was a Protestant, but he was from upper Galway, north of Galway.
North of Galway, not
Took a long while.
Not Belfast.
I found a new cousin about 6 or 7 degrees removed 2 years ago, and she went over and she settled that he came from the north of Galway.
Many people lose track of their families because they left for reasons of family dissension or family disagreement.
If they'd gone on, and one of my cousins who was, I have to tell this so people will understand something about the issues of the difference between Catholics and Protestants in this. That one night I came home from during an air raid and to a place where I was staying when I was getting ready to leave Spain. And this little mountain girl who was the maid keeping the place for some Scandinavian diplomats was sitting there between two candles and looking so beautiful. And I said, oh, Nadia, you make a beautiful saint. And she said, saint? I can never be a saint, giving my good Spanish blood to fascists. So when did you give blood to the fascists? Well, when they were fighting in Barcelona, they asked for blood. And I didn't ask what his politics were, but I didn't want the fascists to have my blood. You know, there's funny things. And here's my one cousin. My grandparents decided finally to be fair as they could, so if The first child was a Protestant. My father, being the ninth and last, was a Protestant. And those in between were Catholics. I don't think the church had a definite policy, or they would have.
You mean that was the church's declaration that the...
Or they did it, I don't know.
Because of the different religions?
They were supposed to swallow up each other, I guess, but that's the way it happened in our family.
Huh.
That they just decided this way, that, of course, Grandpa said the first has to be a Protestant, no? And Grandma, who's a sweet little soul who smoked a pipe, clay one, was apparently all right. But when they were in their 60s, they still were disagreeing about religion, and they separated. And he lived
all
in
of those years.
All
and
of those years, but
still
the
debate
and
continued.
Still debate. But my mother said you would never know that there was any dissension or anything, because she went there as a 17-year-old bride and fell in love with them all, but had severe shocks because they told her she couldn't see her mother-in-law until after supper, and when they took her in, there's this little old lady in a rocking chair with a clay pipe in her mouth. And my mother knew from Cooperstown, provincial Cooperstown, was shocked out of speech.
Yeah, that was quite irregular or uncommon behavior at that time.
I think so, yes. But at least they were trying to be rational. I put that down to their credit. And Grandfather came to see me, but I don't remember him, and my mother was away that day. I was probably about 3 months old. Very nice. He left me one of those beautiful farms. Probably have stayed there and never gone to Spain.
For our audience who's just joined us, I'm speaking with Frederica Martin, recent recipient of an honorary doctorate degree from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and certainly a very valuable Alaskan citizen, and we will get to that eventually. For the audience who isn't so familiar with the conflict in Spain, would you just sort of give a little several-sentence idea of what was going on, what the main issues were on the two sides?
The main issues were that Hitler was starting expansion, and the Catholic Church went along with him because they didn't want the status quo. The minute you got into that, you had a religious feud starting up, and it became very serious. I wanted to say that my cousin who taught Spanish at Middlebury College, during my speaking career afterward, a man came on who'd been in Spain on the program. He said, "Hey, I got a letter from your cousin Rose. She's so happy and waiting to meet you." And I said, "Rose? Why, she's so Catholic, she couldn't marry the man she loved. She can't be working for the Republic." He said, "Little you know, she's the head of the Spanish committee in Middlebury." So I sat down that night and wrote a letter, and she wrote back, "Look, I didn't go to Spain every year for most of my life without realizing that the church helped keep these people, the great big church in a tiny hamlet, and people living in utter poverty. And they are wrong about this." But they didn't want, they're quite right, because once they let all their ideas in, you know, we see it in Latin America today, how many are falling away from the church. Because the church won't stand for a religion which puts people first, I mean, right now.
So it was the formal heads of the church who were aligned?
Yes, but not necessarily the people.
Not necessarily the people.
We had a nurse who was in her 20s who volunteered to go with us, and her family sued the courts to prevent her, in the court, to prevent her going, and the court said she's over 21, she can do what she likes. And I've always been so glad about it, because of all the wonderful women who went, I think she's the only one who could have done what she did. At the fall of Barcelona, she was working in a huge hospital, a Republican hospital of wounded soldiers in Barcelona. And they started out for the frontier, and they had them in ambulances. The chief doctor was a man of such reputation that government had asked him to go ahead and keep an inventory of everything that went over the border. When the people in half of Spain went out of the country, they didn't think they were going out to stay. They thought they were going to get out and get in boats and go to the south, which was still in Republican hands. But the French immediately took over all the arms and the ambulances and everything they could. But this doctor was at least keeping track of the material. Couldn't stop them. And so she was... they had plenty of doctors, but most of them happened to be in Barcelona and didn't care one way or the other, and they didn't want to go to France. And halfway along the road, most of them deserted, taking the ambulances in which you could take the wounded who couldn't walk. But Avi...
These are Spanish doctors?
Yes. Uh-huh. But Avi and some of those who had casts on their legs brought all of them safely across the border. And Herbert Matthews in the New York Times said she was a walking skeleton. She'd been a very beautiful, tall woman, you know, after all this. And it took about a year to get back. And
what was her name again?
Avi Busakesi. And she went on being a good Catholic, you know?
The Spanish Civil War was a real attraction for intellectuals who wanted to put their ideas, their feelings into some kind of more visible behavior. Do you know why that was?
Well, it's like a period now where when we're all seeking for some way of stopping the dissension between peoples. I feel in the same atmosphere of this. You're looking for a way to make friendship, dialogue, not weapons, things like that. And it's very... a very dangerous period, again, like that period was. But most people never thought that Americans knew much about this, you see.
We have some very prominent writers who were there, however.
Yes, the writers, but I mean at the beginning. And then I realized, doing research in New York Library of ordinary papers and trade papers from trade unions, that the people there had been, since Hitler came into power, they were accustomed on payday to put their part, something down on the, pay something toward helping the people that Hitler in his own country was abusing. But it was all quiet. Nobody gave it any publicity that these people were sending money to help and trying to get people away from Hitler. And Jews and non-Jews, great writers. So there was this real stratum of anti-fascists who were not voluble, who were not conspicuous, but steady. And they were the ones who also helped finance the committees. When the Medical Bureau to Aid Spanish Democracy, it was first formed as by the John Dewey people, philosophers of that sort. And they called it, should have said, the Spanish Republic, not Spanish democracy, because democracy had become a dirty word then. And I was sorry, always sorry they changed it. They were after the Republic, not anything vague or
It's amazing
general.
How words twist around and the meaning the way the people or the party that a word is so associated with at one point changes. I mean, all those terms... Democrats, Republicans, democracy,
yes.
And so on. They change through the years, and depending on what country you're in, they have very different meanings.
Be very careful of your language. The defeat of Spain was unnecessary. All they needed were some arms.
More money. More money to buy.
No money. They had money.
They needed arms.
They needed arms.
So they didn't have access to buy.
Because a committee was formed of the nations, a neutrality kind of committee, and won't sell anything. It was not embargo. And that shows what harm an embargo can do. Again and again, some nation would send help. France or England, they would sell something. But just enough.
But it's sporadic, unified, and not...
And half of it wouldn't arrive. Uh-huh. And the Italian boats would sink ships with them. They had lots in the Mediterranean. And most of these terrible... I wonder if all history is like... It seemed to me that most of this muddle was a muddle. It wasn't meanness. It wasn't really vicious feelings on either side.
Or planned.
Or plans that were meant to. It's the same kind of situation I found on the Primrose.
Yeah, we'll get to them in a minute. Something that strikes me, most of the outside help originally that went to the Republican side was citizens organizing committees, just sort of grassroots stuff.
Yes,
the Chancellor, Chancellor O'Rourke, the other day in the commencement address, was saying what we need are individuals making a personal commitment, a commitment of dollars. He suggested that each graduating student would donate $250 over the course of the next 5 years to promote.
I've never heard anything like that. That was wonderful.
World peace. And the second thing he said is that he would like each student that was graduating to commit 10 days in the next 5 years to some organization mm-hmm. that was promoting world peace or an end to hunger. And I'm sorry, I don't have it in my head, but that power of all graduating seniors in the class of 85 in terms of hours contributed and money, something like $3 billion,
yes.
just for a $250 contribution each, if we make that kind of commitment. And these committees you're describing seem very much like that, not formal government policy, but citizens deciding this is something that needs our care and attention.
In our first hospital, I wrote a letter to a friend in New York and said, oh, these wonderful women who are with me, you know, who work so hard and they slap around in bedroom slippers if they have them because their feet are so swollen. Then when I came back to speak and went and met little committees here and ever, I find women with swollen feet after the Saturday night, all week long they've been doing various things. And it was also always something on Saturday night, and somebody said, this is really a plot to make us into alcoholics because somebody has to buy the liquor to make the money for Spain.
Making the money off the bar receipts.
Yes.
You said in passing, and I, for the audience who has just joined us, I'm speaking with Frederica Martin, and we're speaking now about her time as a nurse during the Spanish Civil War, that there were a lot of women there.
Hmm?
You said that there were several women that went, or numerous
yes,
women that went.
Yes, about 52 women
uh-huh.
went in our group, but every country did it. But we were one of the three groups, who came in a coordinated way as a committee. Other people even crossed their borders from Poland or from Czechoslovakia or from Yugoslavia and walked over mountains, and young women came from Israel stowing away in boats and climbed the mountains over from France into Spain. But we went like ladies and gentlemen, you know. We went in the Normandy and wearing uniforms and wondering if, since a few days before the Neutrality Act had been passed, if we were going to, you know, have a few slight wonders. But I never felt it for a minute. I felt the people were with us and nobody's going to do us any harm. They're just going to like us, which was what happened.
Is that what you found?
Yes.
And you nursed in the field, or where were you?
No, you know, going off with these uniforms, there was a mob at the boat to shout and cheer us. And then when we came home, there was very warm welcome. Once in a while, in a few colleges usually, somebody would get up and talk about killing nuns and so forth, and I'd say, do I look like a nun killer? And that would stop it right away. And I said, no one had a policy of killing nuns any more than they had a policy of whom the other side picked out. If they found someone disloyal to their side, then something might happen to them. And they did make the nuns go into hiding. It was better, you know. People, as they lost their relatives in bombing, people don't stay very patient with their philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And that is it. Never forget the first time I was in Madrid to do some shopping, and there'd been this bombing, and they let us, because we were in uniform, go through to the area afterward to go to some stores. As I explained, I had to get back to the hospital in the country. And I see a little hand, and I think maybe it's a baby, and I start scrabbling in this, and all I have is a little hand. It's the most awful thing in the world to do something like that. recently it occurred to me that somehow I think of a lot of our wars in terms of children's pictures. One is the child, the baby crying, which sitting in the railroad tracks of a Chinese hospital, a Chinese station that had been blasted. And then there's those children running down the street and road in Vietnam, and the clothes have been taken off by the fire burners. And things like that. I mean, there's every war that's got something like that.
Uh-huh. You know, war is the sign in the 60s. War is dangerous to children and other living things.
Yes, that was wonderful. You know, some years ago I wrote to that committee and asked them, because somebody swiped my pin that said that. And they said, we don't make it anymore. But I said, you must.
It's such a wonderful phrase, and it really, really shows we can't avoid but harming innocent victims when that kind of conflagration is ongoing.
No,
so you came back to this country, and then you did a speaking tour to explain to anyone who was willing to listen what was going on there.
Oh, I'm so popular. I'd be making a speech in a fairly large town, and three little villages would send to come and know if interrupt, walk through the door. Can you come and speak for us Sunday night?
So there was great curiosity.
Oh,
was the press not covering this at
the
time or at that point?
Well, the press did its best, but in Salt Lake City, for instance, they had a long article about the royalist nurse after my interview with them. Things like that. You know, they didn't understand very much.
Do you think the press has changed now? I mean, are people giving more information now?
I think people are. But I don't find as much information about the situation in Latin America correctly given. I mean, to read that we're going to have a revolution in Mexico, where I've lived for nearly 35 years, takes my breath away. The one thing people are striving to do is to get things better and get them straightened out. Mexicans, when there's trouble, don't go to the governor and say, we need some money. Mama goes and finds something and makes some sandwiches and takes them down the street and sells them.
Mm-hmm.
Papa goes out in the backyard and looks for an old crate or something, and he builds something very prettily. And they try selling it. So the streets are swamped with sellers in our city, Cuernavaca, Morelos. We've had to do something about it because people are pressing in after the late earthquake. Mm-hmm. They're frightened to stay. There are tremors every few days. And also, some government agencies are being moved down, and they're looking for a place to live. So the reason I have a cane after my fall is that in the streets there, if I didn't have that, I'd get knocked down in 2 minutes because people aren't looking where they're going. People who are good-natured and smiling and so forth are rushing like mad.
So a different atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
5-year-old kids, that's one of the things always so amazing to me about Mexico, is how industrious and conscientious the children, young children seem to be. I mean, they have their own little businesses unbelievably young ages.
Yes.
5 years old, they're out selling chiclets.
And one of the reasons for wanting large families is that you have more children out in the streets selling and doing things. And
larger labor pool.
Keep a whole pinch going.
Since we're discussing Mexico briefly, I heard a recent story on Morning Edition that, in fact, the government progress of rebuilding was going very slowly, and that citizen groups that were trying to organize to do their own building and to obtain the necessary permits and even perhaps to solicit independent funds and to sort of streamline this bureaucratic quagmire were not getting support from the government. How is the recovery going?
The government is really so far from the people, way, way up. And we have a president who's marvelous in many ways. He's one of the reasons we still have peace in Latin America, because the other nations follow him. He's a man of great integrity. But he's not an easy man. He's not a friendly man like a politician is here. He's off. But he gives rules. You do this, you do that. And these people aren't used to rushing and doing things. People who have bureaucratic jobs there take it easy and see whether they can get their cousin in at the same time. And nobody pays enough attention when somebody is inventive and wants to improve the work there. Well, that's out of the way. I have a 23-year-old grandson who wants to wants to become a U.S. citizen as soon as possible, if he can, because of that very attitude, because he's got a mother who's a very active woman and a grandmother like me, and he doesn't see life as the young people that he went to school with.
So the system itself is...
They're just looking for something to get where they have a safe nook. And they're right, because that's the way life has been there. They need to get established and keep quiet and everything will be right.
So the system doesn't encourage innovation and...
No. And, you know, people have been bewailing the loss of the middle class in Mexico. Well, the middle class isn't the middle class like anywhere else. In the middle class, people try to look after their interests and build and grow, and therefore they're taking an interest in life about them. But there, if they have a business, well, let's just see it, you know. They don't go out and see what they can do. When Mexicans come to the United States, they make the very best workers, it seems. There have been enough reports on this, and I know it. And I know that when they have a chance and when they're in an ambient where they can produce, how they can be.
When it's rewarded.
But that's right, when they get their dues. I mean, if you work, when I left to come up here, a dollar was worth 508 pesos, and the minimum wage is 560 pesos, I think.
What an incredible inflation rate.
And we've been trying to avoid being like Argentina was a few years ago. But
a few years ago, it was 20 pesos to the dollar. I mean,
when I went there, it was 12 and a half.
12 and a half.
And 1950. But
now it's 580. My goodness. Hold on.
It's a very terrible. And the president's lost in a dream, not only of how rich Mexico is with oil, also inveigled by banks who wanted to lend them money. Mm-hmm. To have that. People came and urged them to invest in this or that.
Obviously, Alaska's our economy has been clearly and negatively impacted by the decline in oil revenues, which is almost like a buzz phrase around here. But an economy as fragile as Mexico's has really been devastated, and you combine that with the natural disaster.
There's now a decision we're going to be an agricultural country. I mean, everybody always thought of it as an agricultural country. But it is for somebody who lives on a subsistence level, and it's not a productive one. 68% of the food that's exported and so forth is by foreign companies. And so there's a great fight now whether to let foreign investments... Just before I left, I'm a permanent immigrant. And I can do a lot of things except work in a cantina. But I've never worked
in a... Would you have ambitions to work in a cantina?
Well, I feel frustrated. I'd like to do a slide or something.
All you have to do to frustrate you is to say, no, you can't do this, Frederica, and you want to do it.
I feel like that. But the thing is that this saw this heading, that we must go and re-register because of lost documents. And then I read the article, and then I called the embassy, said, no, the office, and they said, no, that's all right. We're just not going to have that status of a foreign living here because they take jobs. And I said, oh, you mustn't do that. Think all the people who are retired here who hire 7 servants and have lots of guests. This is crazy. You just take that item out. They can't work, that's all.
Right. Don't do shotgun.
And I'm thinking of writing the president a letter when I get back.
Don't do shotgun administration. Do specific administration. If you don't want people to work, don't allow them to work, but still allow them to come and live. There are quite a few sort of expatriate American communities in Mexico of long duration. Right.
And more people have been living there because it was pleasant and
good,
especially
weather
around Cuernavaca. You have a beautiful climate most of the time. You're going to have a drought right now, so I don't know what's happening to our reputation.
At the end, now I'm speaking with Frederica Martin for those of you who just joined us. At the end of your speaking tour after the Spanish Civil War, Is that the time that you and your husband decided to come to Alaska?
I was asked shortly after I came back to go to Greenbelt, Maryland by someone who said I was very good at making hospitals out of nothing. Greenbelt, Maryland was an experiment in cooperation. And it stemmed from some Englishman who years ago saw the congested cities in the future and said every town should leave space to have a green belt where people would have everything but manufacture. Now, Mexico was made for that kind of thing because every large community had ejidos or communal farms.
Uh-huh.
And if they had just let them go on, but people were stealing it to put houses up, you see, they'd get away from the people by offering them so much money or getting a judge to do it because they were not supposed to sell these lands. Mm-hmm. And Mexico City, still a few years ago, had a pretty good ring of such, and it has only a few left. Some time ago, I wrote to the News, the English paper, and said, I'm not writing, Dad, I don't want you to print this letter. I just want to say, won't you look into this question of ejidos? Mm-hmm. And see what you can do. And the next week, lo and behold, a man and an officer of the Confederation of Agricultural Societies made a speech, but he didn't talk about the ejidos. He talked about having a green belt. And that meant, because if you don't, you know...
If you have those kinds of green belts, you have the means of at least basic agricultural production that doesn't require major transportation and that will...
Why do we in Cuernavaca have to have rotten bananas that come from 40 or 50 miles away and stand in a car somewhere when we can have them from 5 miles, 2 miles away,
mm-hmm.
and people can live better?
So that was
the
idea.
People are beginning to demand it. They don't get good prices in bulk.
Mm-hmm. So that was the idea in Greenbelt, Maryland, when you went?
Well, that was trying out the idea, but we were a long way from the city. It was quite a bus ride.
When was this? What year was that?
I went in 39. Greenbelt started in 36.
Okay.
And it was one of the most serious things I ever met in my life. There was more meetings and more thinking out problems in that community than the United Nations and the League of Nations put together.
Everything decision was made without a committee deliberation.
Or the community got together. And it was a very beautiful town then. We had a rolling land and space between the buildings. And then we went to...
So you became the hospital architect.
And the collector of turtles. I felt kind of lonely in a singles room apartment looking down on treetops. So I took home a little box turtle I met one morning and let it clump around the place at night. One of my nurses heard about it. The next time she came from a ball game, she brought me an ashtray from Maryland University, which has a big turtle on its lawn. And one day, some of the men drove up, workmen in the grounds, drove up with a whole lot of turtles and dug a hole in the backyard in the hospital and put the turtles down. And every once in a while, somebody else would come along with a turtle, and I had hundreds. Began to turn them loose. And then while I was there, I became married to Dr. Berenberg. And after a while, I was going to have a baby, so I wasn't working. And in May of 1950, I'm sitting in our back garden, and I'm thinking, if it's as hot as this in August, how the devil am I going to stand having a baby in a hospital in Washington?
All pregnant women say they're hot. You know, somehow your temperature goes up when you get pregnant, and that was just too hot for you, huh?
Oh, boy, but it was hot in May, too. It was real. And the phone rang, and that was the day in this cooperative medical setup that my husband shouldn't have to work in the afternoon. But ringing telephone always attracted him, so he went into the house, and he called out of the window and said, how would you like to go to an island in the Bering Sea? What would you say? But I didn't say it. I said, sounds nice. I was very cautious. And we went in to see the Fish and Wildlife Service. And he said, how did you know about me? He said, oh. And he showed a very old list of people who had put their names down as candidates for civil jobs in federal hospitals. He'd done it in his medical school time. and they were scraping the bottom of the barrel. And they got us because I didn't like hot weather. I'm sure. And so we went for, he got a leave of absence of a year as being the town public health doctor and from the health association. And off we went in a rush and began, and they were very sorry. The Fish and Wildlife, sorry, were not very happy about me. They say they asked people for a long time, is your wife right?
But at first you said earlier in a little brief conversation we had that they were happy because they were sort of getting two for one because they found out that you were a nurse. So originally, before they found out that you were a pamphleteer.
And
they,
I became troublesome and it cost them a lot of money.
So before they found out that, they were happy that you were a nurse. And what did you find when you arrived in the
Well, I mean, it's always so exciting. You come to this kind of terrain, the very little hills and beautiful flowers everywhere. And then these animals, you have a glimpse of them, and birds massed on the cliffs. And it's a wonderland. And it should be one of the greatest tourist spots in the world in the right season of the year, both this island. I think they have a lot of tourists now, but they're done by private organizations, I think, who make the most money. And not the people. I don't know. Because letters don't tell much.
You're on your way there.
Yes.
Okay. Are you excited?
Oh, I can't tell you. I can't measure my feelings about anything now. I'm walking in air and. It's tremendous. And
so you arrived in June?
Yes, in June.
In 1950.
Mm-hmm. And in 1951, we were evacuated after Dutch Harbor was bombed. And, I'd been always going to write, maybe write a little thing, but I was going to write, and finally the Pribilovians kicked me into writing. And I was taking notes and reading everything I could on the island. There were lots of books and things and asking people. And so I produced a book called The Hunting of the Silver Fleece. I was equally interested in what happened to the animals, because what happens to the people on islands like that depends on what they can make a living at.
Go the animals, so go the people.
Yes.
Inextricably tied to one another.
But now they, I don't know whether this year, I knew early in the spring that they were asking permission to kill 25,000 young bachelors for food.
We're talking fur seals now.
Yeah. I don't know whether they got permission or not.
I don't know. Back to 1950. 51 was the...
evacuation.
The evacuation. What was that like?
It was very dramatic. We'd been having unmarked planes buzzing around, and they'd go past on the levels of the terraces of the village. So much so that I started to dig a hole in the ground, and the agent then let me continue and sent me help to take the patients to a good solid place if these planes were...
Little evacuation. Did you have a lot of information about what military...
We didn't know what was going on except what we heard over the... Japanese, English broadcast from Japan. So we knew about Attu being captured, and then we heard the Americans say, well, that's just an old rock out in the Pacific. And the best radio we had was in the hospital with an old man we had there, and very wise old man. And he looked so sad, and he said, you know, if that's what they still think of us in the States, we're lost. And they come. And then he went on to explain that there had been Japanese fishery students brought there to see the techniques and so forth. And he said they even measured the windows. He said they're coming prepared to put glass in the windows, he said, if they break them. And within a short time, on the Sunday, I decided I wasn't going to leave my baby, nor an Ali girl who was living with me, or my servant in town to be bound. And we went out to an old hunting camp where they had the old-time houses and cleaned out the half-underground cabin and put up some bunks and left some food. And then my husband came to get them, and I said to him, instead of going back with you, now I want to meet me at Zapadne because I want to walk that piece. I've never walked that piece of shore. It's the case the last time. So I'm strolling along, having a wonderful time walking there. Every once in a while, a cloud would park, and the clouds would park so you could see it part. So you would see a little boat bobbing. And we'd been seeing it off and on for a couple of weeks. We didn't know who it was, and they didn't know who we were, and they didn't know what to do, and they were supposed to give us messages. And that day, while I was still wandering around my last piece of land, they had to get in and tell us that we were to be evacuated the next day. They had a little tiny cannon. It was a little tiny boat that had been pressed into service that wouldn't usually be doing anything important. And out went our assistant agent and some of the men, trembling. Everybody was trembling on both sides. And they called weakly from the boat, anybody here speak English? Yes, of course. Oh, you mean you're not Japanese? Oh, is everybody happy? And by the time Sam came for me and got me back to the village, people were dancing in the street. Oh, Freddy, we're going out. We're going outside. We're going to be free. And they had a glorious night. They packed everything. They took the electric washing machines, the standing lamps. It was very foggy the next morning, so our photos are very blurred. You can detect what they are. And the captain was rather confused because he was working for the Army. They had hired his ship to take arms, specifically, to the Lucians. And the Navy got upset about us, and knowing that the ship which had the planes which bombed on Harbor the 3rd of June, not too far west of us, waiting to decide what to do, it was a great movement they had planned to go after Wake and ours and capture the two. I don't know why they slowed up on us. Nobody knows, I don't think. And to keep fighting, and it was some time before they landed on a couple of more islands beside us too. But I packed the whole hospital that night.
Did you get to take everything with you?
Yes.
I mean, all
well, I didn't take my the furniture belonged in that house, but I took everything that we
but
had.
But people did get to take
people
with them
what
they wanted. There weren't limits.
St. Paul. And everybody was happy. They were going to have a new life, you see. They were going outside. But I don't know why I was alone on the top deck when the people landed from St. George in the morning. And they were told one package. And they came weeping. And one with a cat. And another with a pail of milk. And the cat and the milk didn't go together until later. Someone who milked the cows couldn't bear. He went and milked the cows and brought the milk on because he wouldn't race them.
So quickly they had to make the decision that they couldn't even make
and
good decisions.
And being told they can't bring anything.
At the last minute.
Yeah. So they, as we sailed out, past the cemetery, they began weeping and praying and singing prayers. And their priest prayed. And then St. Paul realized what was happening to them, and they were up on the upper deck too, weeping and crying and praying. And St. George was right, because they were extra natives brought into a crowded community. They were dumped in, we have to thank Icarus for the fact that they were left in Alaska, because he had a great battle with the Fish and Wildlife Service. He wanted to take them to a healthier place than where they were dumped, because there wasn't any place to take them. In Thunder Bay, there was just as little of the shoreline open, and old barracks for fishermen that the wood was rotting, and a great... was a terrible experience for the American personnel from the island. They were all middle-aged people, and most of them had, you know, had a hard time in those years. And they came up there, and they had a steady job, and as long as they kept it, they were safe forever, you know. And suddenly they're thrust out. And suddenly the natives became very dear to them. And they said they must stay with the natives and take care of them. And rushed around and tried to make friends with people, you know, and poor natives didn't know what was happening to them. Because the kind of atmosphere that when they came to eat in my house, they kind of asked for extra protection because my food was prepared by an Aleut. I mean, there were prejudices there that are so silly, you know.
How long did you stay in that relocation camp?
I didn't stay. Both of us went right down to Seattle with the ship, but my husband went right back as soon as he saw us. We had to show the family. We told them our families were expecting a grandchild, and we didn't.
Your child was what, about?
I couldn't
few
stay up
old.
There.
Yeah, right.
So I went on, and Sam came a good many months later because it was very difficult to get anyone, and he stayed until they absolutely had a doctor. And an old doctor who had been in the service, hearing about the need for doctors, volunteered. Mm-hmm. A sweet old man that I had corresponded with for years after that. And a very kindly man, and with no nonsense about racism. People were people to him. But when the people, first of all, the first shock to Fish and Wildlife that they couldn't get over was these particular people in Fish and Wildlife. It was that the army arrived and started drafting young men, and they said, "You can't do that. These are people that belong to the government. You can't do it. They're serfs. They're this, they're that. They're very wards."
Wards.
Wards was a dirty word. I've been trying to think of it for 2 days. Wards, and you can't take them. The army said, "What do you mean you can't?" And they called Washington, and Washington called a conference of lawyers, and said, "Oh, yes." They were one of the settled tribes that was accepted. Citizens.
But then they were let.
But
they were allowed to come
them.
Back to do fur harvest.
Well, I mean, when the treaty with Russian was signed, the settled tribes were admitted as, but they didn't mention any of them by name, and who knew anything about
real
them?
Confusing status and
this
real unclear.
This was just a human muddle that grew up from ignorance. Who knew there were people on the islands? For that matter, how many people knew there were fur seals? Only the smart ones who persuaded Seward to buy it.
Right.
And so they, and the first raid, right, immediately ships went up to get all when the next season began, they're killing seals on all sides, and there was anarchy. Nobody knew what to do about anything. And then gradually it was straightened out, and they made a man had been very foreseeing. He jumped off the ship in the morning before we took over Alaska, and bought Russian possessions. And they were very unclear about that.
Uh-huh. He brought in property from the Russians before the
yes.
transition between Russia
yes,
and the
United States.
Yes, they
sent over a prince to take uh-huh, care of uh-huh. it as the head of the Russian fur company and so forth.
Real claim jumper.
And then in the afternoon, the men came back on board, and in the afternoon they all went off and took possession, uh-huh. put up the flag. Then they had to decide to whom they're going to lease the rights to hunt. It took a couple of years before that was settled, but the company that sent the man ashore, he owned this position in Sitka. So that was a beginning. With that, he managed to get the rights to seal in Alaska.
I have to interrupt here because what has happened, much to my dismay and disbelief, is that we are fast running out of time. Are you going to be back in Fairbanks?
No, from the islands.
You're going
straight back home.
Straight back to Mexico.
Yes.
Well, I hope that you will come back to Fairbanks next year, if not on this trip, at least again, because obviously we've just begun the discussion of your adventures in Alaska. You've been working in the archives this week because you, in fact, purchased a large collection of documents and papers so that
I've been looking over the things I bought in Spain and trying to get them in order and be sure that we haven't missed so much, because I'm going back to Spain, I hope, in early February.
And whose papers were these?
These are on the expeditions of the Spaniards who came to Upper California, now known as Alaska.
Well, this is fascinating, and there are many questions that I would love to ask, and I'm sure that our audience would love to hear your answers, too. It has been absolute pleasure for me to spend this time with you, Frederica Martin. You've had a wonderful life. You're a real inspiration, and I hope that you will come back to Fairbanks, and if you do, that you will come and visit with us again.
I'd just like to say, to add to the speech the other day at the end, if people do what's right, there are times when people blow their skirts away from you, but the time comes when you reap great fortune.
Okay, do such what's right and reap great fortune. This has been Home Fires Radio Show. I've been your host, Patty Kostelic. Our executive producer is Carla Tonella. Follow Frederica Martin's very good advice and have a good weekend.